Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require operator assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Mesner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Amanda, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Connect workshop, Treatment Update on Liver Cancer and Managing the Costs of Care. Now, today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations. And it's because of that collaboration and your interest in the topic today that we have so many of you on the call today. Now, there are 517 participants on the call, and you come from all over the United States, so all different parts of the United States, all different regions. And we also have international participants from Brazil, Canada, Egypt, Kenya, Saudi Arabia, Tanzania, United Kingdom, and Venezuela. So you're really from all over the world. It's a bit of a global call, isn't it, with everyone on the call from everywhere. And today's program has been made possible by a contribution from Lilly, and I really want to thank them for their support of this program today. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Ahmed Kassab. Dr. Kassab is Associate Professor and Director of Hepatocellular Carcinoma Program, Department of Gastrointestinal Medical Oncology, the University of Texas, MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Dr. Kassab is going to present an overview of liver cancer, current standard of care, and new treatment approaches. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Kassab.
Thank you very much, Dr. Mesner. It's a great honor for me to be with all of you guys today. So I'll be talking today about some overview about the liver cancer, followed by current standard of care, and then finish by talking about some new treatment approaches. So when it comes to hepatocellular carcinoma, it's a very common disease worldwide. Also, incidence has been rising in recent years due to the metabolic syndrome rising incidence, which is a combination of hypertension, diabetes, high cholesterol, and obesity. So therefore, a lot of these patients develop liver injury and eventually liver cirrhosis, and then hepatocellular carcinoma or liver cancer evolves. So that's the main reason for the recent rise in the incidence of hepatocellular carcinoma. So we always think about it as a syndrome of two diseases. In one hand, we have the liver tumor, and in the other hand, we have the underlying liver disease that led to liver cancer in the first place. So this syndrome of the two diseases really affects all aspects of liver cancer management. So we decide on which treatment approach to pick based on this, a combination of the tumor stage and the degree of the underlying liver cirrhosis. So we pick up the treatment based on a combination of both staging systems, liver tumors and the liver cirrhosis, and therefore patients with very advanced liver cirrhosis may be offered fewer options because of the risk of precipitating liver failure if we go very aggressive. So that takes me to talking about the current standard of care. So the top option, which is the only curative option, is surgery. So we do either resection if the tumor is small and the liver disease is not very advanced, so that's why it could handle the surgery. So if the tumor is very small and the liver is in excellent shape and liver function is good, then we go for resection, which is curative in these cases. However, if the tumor is very small yet the liver cirrhosis or the liver injury is very advanced, then we go for liver transplant option. So I have to say the combination of cases amenable for surgical resection or liver transplant together is very small. It's about 10 to 15% of cases. So therefore, the rest of the patients would be divided into two categories, patients with very advanced liver disease to a point where it's risky to do any kind of treatment. And in these cases, we only offer hospice and focus on symptom management. And then the rest of the cases could be amenable for a combination of local therapies or systemic therapies. And by systemic therapies, we mean pill form or IV. So let's start talking a little bit about the local therapy approaches for hepatocellular carcinoma. So basically, we divide them into either ablative treatments like radiofrequency ablation, for example, which is a needle we stick from this side, and then we burn the tumor. That's for very small tumors, up to 3 to 5 centimeters in diameter. And if they are bigger than this, then we start thinking about catheter treatment approaches through the groin, like having a heart cath, and then we go up to the liver and then inject either chemotherapy, which we call transarterial chemoembolization, or TACE, T-A-C-E. Some of you guys might have heard about it. And if we inject radiation spheres, we call it Y90 or yttrium 90. So that's the catheter treatment approaches for tumors that are limited to the liver with no spread beyond the liver. Now, if the tumors or the patients are not going to be able to handle these catheter approaches due to technical reasons, or if there is any spread beyond the liver, then we start thinking about systemic approaches, which, as I said earlier, it's in the form of pill form or IV form. So the only drug approved by the FDA for systemic therapy for hepatocellular carcinoma is a drug called Nexavar, N-E-X-A-V-A-R, and it's a pill form. Patients take it every day, twice a day, and then every couple of months we get a new scan to make sure that it is maintaining the tumors and containing them with no increase in size or any spread. So it's basically like a maintenance kind of treatment just to contain the tumors. So basically it doesn't lead to cure. So let's sum it up. Surgery in the form of resection or transplant are the only curative options. However, they are available only for 10 to 15% of cases. Then if not a candidate, we go for local therapy if it is limited to the liver in the form of either ablation through needle approaches or radiation from outside the body, or we go for catheter treatments through the groin and then go up to the liver, inject chemotherapy or radiation spheres. And the last option is the pill called Nexavar for patients with more advanced disease. So this is the current standard of care. Now let's move on to the last portion of our talk, which is basically new treatment approaches. So let's also divide them into local approaches and systemic approaches. So local approaches basically in the form of new agents to be introduced through the catheters. So it could be new formulation of chemotherapy or different formulation of the radiation spheres. And there is a lot of advances in this area with current clinical trials to test the new drugs and new spheres. Also, one of the new approaches is to combine Nexavar Plus, the local therapy approaches, at the same time to see if it is going to be better than either one of them alone in a randomized fashion. And then in the systemic therapy area, there is also new advances in immunotherapy, which is drugs we give to enhance the immunity at the tumor level to help the body fight the tumor. This approach has been approved for melanoma and lung cancer for specific patient populations, and now it's under experimental approaches for liver cancer. So we have a lot of other systemic therapy drugs coming up in clinical trial setting to enhance the activity of Nexavar, and some of them are being compared head-to-head with Nexavar. So this is The new treatment approaches, mainly clinical trials, systemic or local or combination of both. So this is basically what I wanted to tap into today to talk about the overview of the liver cancer, current standard of care, and the new treatment approaches. So you can tell from the discussion that I alluded to that we have limited approaches and we have a syndrome of two diseases here. So really the most critical thing to do is to diagnose early on through adherence to screening programs. So if you have any of the risk factors for liver cancer, we talked about the metabolic syndrome, of course, anybody with hepatitis or alcohol-related liver cirrhosis, you should be checked by your primary care physician and get screened for liver cancer. The current guidelines regarding screening of patients with cirrhosis involves ultrasound and a blood test every 6 months, twice a year. So the key is to early diagnose, so that way we can be among the 10 to 15% of patients who could get curative options such as resection or transplant. And if the patient is not lucky enough to get the tumor diagnosed that early, then we move on to local therapy approaches, plus or minus systemic, and I talked about the new treatment approaches, which some of them are very promising. So you should also discuss with your physician regarding any new approaches for your specific disease stage. So I'll end my discussion here, and I'd like to thank Dr. Messner and team very much for involving me. It was a real pleasure being with you guys today. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Kassab. That was a wonderful presentation, wonderful overview of liver cancer and both the standard of care and new treatment approaches. So thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. James Harding. Dr. Harding is Assistant Attending, Gastrointestinal Oncology Service, Developmental Therapeutics Center, Department of Medicine, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And Dr. Harding is going to address clinical trials, controlling symptoms and pain, and communicating with your healthcare team about quality of life and financial concerns. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Harding.
Thank you very much. I'd like to thank all of you for your attention, and I look forward to the questions afterward. Also, I'd like to thank Dr. Kassab for that review. So today I'll talk about clinical trials, and clinical trials are investigational approaches that physicians use to find new treatments for cancer, as well as to learn more about cancer and its biology. And when you think about a clinical trial, you can think of them as two major divisions. The first is a non-therapeutic clinical trial, and the second is a therapeutic clinical trial. A non-therapeutic clinical trial is when a doctor may approach you about doing research on perhaps some of your blood or a piece of tumor that was taken previously from a biopsy or even a surgery. And today in hepatocellular carcinoma, these trials are probably quite critical because we understand, as Dr. Kassab said, liver cancers can be derived from a variety of different agents, and we need to understand the biology better to advance the care. So you may be approached by one of your doctors about such a non-therapeutic study, and this is just an opportunity for us to learn more about the biology of cancer. Sometimes they involve quality of life surveys or to understand the process of dealing with cancer, or they may involve quality of life regarding treatment. And these things, I think, aid us in developing new treatments, and they're completely optional. So if you're ever offered a non-therapeutic trial, it's something to consider. More often, though, we talk about therapeutic clinical trials. This is where we're trying to define a new type of cancer therapy for patients with liver cancer, and they can be broken down into three subgroups. Phase one clinical trials are trials where we're using a new approach, usually a drug, where we know that it works in animal models for liver cancer and in cell lines for liver cancer, and we're very interested to develop a new therapy. The purpose of this trial is to understand how the drug works in your body and how your body works on the drug. It's also important to define what the best dose of a drug is and its potential side effects. And once a phase one study is completed, you move on. There are phase two studies, which are basically developing the drug further. We now have determined a safe dose of the drug. We want to see how active it is. The purpose of a phase two trial is to enroll many more patients. Everyone gets the drug typically, and we try to understand how active that drug might be. And at the end of a phase two study, if we determine there is activity of a particular drug or treatment, we move into what's called a phase three clinical study. That's when patients are essentially offered a new treatment versus the standard of care. So as Dr. Kassab said, if you were receiving sorafenib for your liver cancer, that's the standard of care. If we found a drug that we thought worked just as well as sorafenib or better, we would do a randomized phase three clinical trial, which is essentially a way to figure that out and establish a new standard of care. These things are called randomized clinical trials. So it is essentially a flip of a coin as to what arm you get, whether it's the new drug or the sorafenib. And right now across the world, as Dr. Kassab said, there are many approaches that are being looked at on phase three clinical trials to look for new treatments for liver cancer, some of which are drugs, one of which is called ADI-PEG-20. That's an injection that interferes with arginine metabolism. That's being looked at after sorafenib stops working. There are two studies now looking at a drug called, one called cabozantinib, the other called tivatinib. These are drugs that are blocking something called MET, and they're being looked at after sorafenib stops working. And finally, a drug called ramucirumab, which blocks blood vessel growth. That, too, is being looked at on a phase three clinical trial after sorafenib. And of course, there are many other studies that are in planning. At ASCO this year, there was very nice data, although early data, on how drugs that block certain proteins involved with suppressing an immune response called an anti-PD-1 antibody or nivolumab were presented, demonstrating some interesting activity, which will probably be pursued in both phase two clinical studies and maybe further. So there are a number of agents that are now coming in to the care of patients with liver cancer, and that's on the form of clinical trials. Now, the next part of the talk that I'd asked to discuss was controlling symptoms and pain. When dealing with cancer and its treatment, there may be many different forms of discomfort, and it's very important to speak with your care provider to let them know how you're doing and how a drug that they've provided is helping you and also its side effects, because in the process of clinical trials, we also develop treatments for side effects related to drugs. So we do have a number of interventions that we might utilize. So, for example, sorafenib, which is the standard of care in liver cancer, can cause bad rash and sometimes reddening of the hands and feet. We have a whole system in place to monitor and to treat those problems, and it's important to notify your doctor if you notice any of those things. In addition, cancer can cause pain, and in most major cancer centers today, we work with pain doctors that specialize in dealing with patients and their pain. And in cases of liver cancer where many patients do have cirrhosis, it makes choosing the appropriate pain regimen very important. But we're able to give systemic pain medication. We can put patches on that can deliver pain management. Sometimes, if it's required, we can do nerve blocks to stop pain. And then, as Dr. Kassab said, sometimes we can do regional approaches for the purpose of pain management and even radiation therapy. As you go through your journey with cancer, it's very important to know how you're feeling and to communicate that to your doctor so that they can find the best approach for you in dealing with that. And then I think the next portion of the talk that I was going to talk about today was dealing with the price of cancer care. If you were at or heard of ASCO 2015 this year, we had one of the first times at the plenary session, which is where all the major advances in cancers are met, a talk on value in cancer care. And as we move into this time in medicine, cancer care is becoming more and more expensive, both the drugs, both the traveling to the center. Really, every aspect of cancer care comes with some cost. And for some people, even those with excellent insurance, those costs can be, in some sense, prohibitive. And doctors are aware of that, and they really hope to have an open dialogue with their patients about that, because as we can start that process early, we can define what you need and try to help you so that you can get the treatment that you need. For example, sorafenib, which is the standard of care, is quite expensive. Sometimes it can be up to $10,000 a month just for a 1 month's worth of treatment. And because of that, there are actually programs, one of which is called the REACH program, which was developed in combination with the developer of the drug to get reduced pricing for the drug. In addition, sometimes for cancer care, such as embolizations or regional approaches, you may need to travel to a center that has expertise in doing those procedures, and you may need to have either hotel stays or travel flight or to transit to those centers. And there are a number of programs that can help with that. Corporate Angels is one of them, which can help defray cost of travel for flight to specific centers. Some centers, like major cancer centers, will have a really reduced hotel rates or even work with places like the Hope Lodge in New York, that if you're coming for a set of treatment, you might be able to gain access to such a program where you may have lodging there. On clinical trials, occasionally there will be, a small stipend for maybe one or two hotel stays. It's very complicated. It's critical, I think, to bring this up with a healthcare provider so that they can help you find ways to deal with your cancer so that that stress is relieved. For example, at our institution, we have a set patient financial services that can help interface in what is becoming a more and more complicated system of insurance and paying for these costs. And I think the punchline is often patients are worried about bringing these things up, but you shouldn't be, because what our goal is to improve your quality of life and treat your cancer, and we want to help in any way that we can within reason to get you what you need and allow you to have treatment that is important for your cancer. So I think then I have 1 minute left, but that was the area that I wanted to talk about, and of course I'll have the opportunity to answer your questions. So I will turn this now back over to Dr. Messner.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Harding. That was really superb and really wonderful, and covering all the issues and also spending some time with the financial challenges that people face as well. So thank you so much, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you. And our next speaker is Diana Bearden, and Ms. Bearden is a dietitian, and she is actually a supervisor of clinical nutrition, the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Ms. Bearden is going to address nutritional concerns and tips. And now it's my pleasure to turn the program over to Ms. Bearden.
Thank you, Carolyn. I'm excited to be part of today's presentation to address the nutritional concerns in the presence of liver cancer. My goal is to discuss tips for managing side effects that can impact your nutrition. Eating well during your treatment can provide you the energy to do the things you enjoy, as well as maintaining your weight and help with healing. Patients who maintain good nutrition tend to tolerate treatments better and have a faster recovery. Excessive weight loss can cause treatment delays, breaks in treatment, and slow healing. By meeting nutritional goals during your treatment and maintaining your weight, preserving lean muscle mass, those are all key components in accomplishing the goal. So just to start with, a common side effect patients may experience is nausea, vomiting, a decrease in appetite, possibly changes in their taste, mouth sores, diarrhea, constipation, and maybe even fatigue are all common challenges that may be experienced and pose barriers to meeting your nutritional goals. To start with, nausea and vomiting or a poor appetite, ways to address these issues may be eliminating offending odors. It might be helpful to focus on colder foods. They carry less odor, or even bland foods if you're feeling nauseated. So trying dry crackers, toast, or avoiding overly sweetened foods. Those fried and greasy foods or even highly seasoned can give you some difficulty as well. To look at the appetite, though, a lot of times patients feel full or uncomfortable just depending on what they're experiencing. But doing small, frequent meals throughout the day consisting of high-calorie and high-protein foods can be helpful in not feeling overwhelmed with eating, but doing this in small amounts and being able to still meet your calorie and protein goals. Trying to be as relaxed as possible during meal times and actually be able to sit down and enjoy your meal, we sometimes don't recognize, but stress can really have an impact on our digestion, to where, you know, what we would be eating and tolerating in a less stressful situation definitely changes whenever you're under a lot of stress. So trying to allow yourself time to eat and sit down and focus on that. Occasionally, exercise can be helpful. And I bring this up because a lot of folks feel that even walking or, you know, how much should I be doing? But this can really, really work to help stimulate your appetite and digestion. So, you know, if the doctor hasn't put any restrictions on you, discussing this and what they feel is comfortable is something to consider. It really makes a difference with patients who are having issues with their appetite. Another side effect might be a change in taste, and keeping good oral hygiene is kind of a baseline. Sometimes we forget. You're tired, or you're forgetting taking medications, and sometimes just even between meals, that can help cleanse the palate and eliminate maybe a bad taste that's in your mouth. Rinsing your mouth with even some baking soda and water can help as well. And, you know, sometimes there's just a bad taste in your mouth, and sometimes things just don't have a taste. So working with their healthcare team to address what you're experiencing is really important. This can have a huge impact on the foods that you're eating, the nutrients that you're getting in. So, but mouth sores is something that some patients experience. It really just depends on your treatment. But if you are going through treatment and have issues with mouth sores, choosing soft and moist foods that are easy to chew and swallow is encouraged. Avoiding things that are rough in texture, things like chips and foods that have a crispy exterior, even a lot of raw crispy fruits and vegetables. You don't think about that sometimes, but that can be very uncomfortable. Foods that are acidic, tart, or spicy can cause irritation as well. And being sure to cut your foods into smaller amounts. When you don't have sensitivity, sometimes you're not aware of how a bolus of food can react in your mouth when you do have mouth sores until it gets to that point. So just doing small amounts and then being sure to drink to keep your mouth cleansed in between. Supplement drinks might be helpful. Really, we encourage a whole foods approach as often as possible, and even making, blending items or making high-calorie snacks out of food is really encouraged. But drinking and getting enough fluid in is also something that we need to be cognizant of, because that can have an impact as well if you do have sores in your mouth, to keep that mouth moist. A change in bowel function is something patients also may experience, potentially either constipation or diarrhea, or sometimes you can have it where you're experiencing the side effects going back and forth. The issue is to recognize why you're having it, because it will be addressed based on that. We can have constipation for a lot of different reasons, and we can have diarrhea for a lot of different reasons. So it's not necessarily how you may have treated it if you weren't going through treatment, but rather talking with your team about this so that you don't make the situation worse or make you more uncomfortable. And last but least, I just wanted to touch on the fatigue that patients experience, and getting enough fluid, meeting your nutritional goals can really help. If you're able to do exercise, that's important too, to maintain that lean muscle mass for your endurance and daily activities. But if things are coming up and you're really struggling to accomplish any of these goals, be sure to communicate with your healthcare team, even arrange time to speak with your dietitian, and it's always better sooner than later. I hope this has been helpful, and this concludes my thoughts. I'm going to hand it back over to Carolyn.
Oh, thank you so much, Diana. That was really excellent, really superb, very well covered, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Sarah Kelly. Sarah is an oncology social worker, and she's our older adult program coordinator at Cancer Care. And Ms. Kelly is going to address a number of issues: coping with direct medical costs, related non-medical costs, and daily living expenses, sources of financial assistance, Cancer Care's free psychosocial programs and services, and the role of support groups. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Ms. Kelly.
Thank you, Dr. Messner, and I'd actually like to thank everyone on this call. I think we've gotten some really great information. So as Dr. Messner said, my name is Sarah Kelly. I'm an oncology social worker here at Cancer Care, and I'm going to be speaking about a major concern, which Dr. Harding also brought up and addressed, which is, how am I going to pay for my care? Cancer, as you know, is an expensive illness. Financial concerns are understandable, as well as a significant source of stress. But I think that having an open conversation about the cost of cancer can really help you become better informed about your options, financial options, and the hope is that you'll be able to reduce the financial impact of the illness and, of course, on your stress. First and foremost, you want to understand your insurance policy so you're not blindsided by charges. You know, I can't stress how important this is. Read your policy carefully to understand benefits, and contact your insurance provider with any questions. You know, I recommend going through it. Anything you see that you're not quite understanding or questions that aren't addressed, you want to write those down. Some of the big ones are, what portion of the medical expenses am I responsible for paying? Is my doctor or my doctors part of this plan? That's another big one. And, bringing those questions to them, your insurance company also may be able to assign you a case manager. So you want to ask them about that, too. And that's someone that can help you navigate some of the insurance coverage issues. If you're not covered under health insurance, talk to the treatment center, talk to your doctors, talk to the hospital financial services department, also your local department of health, and find out what benefits you may be eligible for and apply for those. I also recommend, and Dr. Harding talked about this, talking to your healthcare team as soon as possible, as soon as you can, about your financial situation. Some healthcare providers don't always ask patients about their coverage or ability to pay. Additionally, patients don't always feel comfortable sharing that information with their provider, but it's so important just in terms of resolving financial issues. You know, we talked about that increasing your stress. It also may limit access to treatment. Dr. Harding talked about that too. Really, you know, patients and providers can work together to devise ways of reducing costs without compromising your treatment. So you want to talk to the medical team about it. You want to connect with patient financial services department, social worker, patient advocate, you know, someone there at your treatment center. You want to let them know. Some things you can do, you may be able to reduce charges. You may be able to engage in a payment plan. They may also have special funding available. So that's really something to look into. You know, the other piece of this, too, is as the bills start coming in, which can be incredibly overwhelming because here you are, you may be paying the office copays, and then these other bills start coming in. Don't ignore the bills. Please don't ignore them. You know, once they go into collections, they're harder to resolve, and then you're also then dealing with the stress of having these collection agencies call you. And I know this sounds like a tall order, especially when you're not feeling well, but there are organizations that can help or at least help direct you to resources for help. So aside from your treatment center, doctor's office, where can you go for information? So I'm going to start with just some of the big ones out there. So Cancer Care, that's us. You can always call us and talk to someone on our Hope Line. Our social workers are here to help you address some of these issues. American Cancer Society also provides patient navigators that can help you address this. And then there's the Cancer Financial Assistance Coalition, which is a website that's great. And I'm assuming you have these numbers and websites in your brochures, but I'm going to just briefly mention the Cancer Financial Assistance Coalition. Basically, a group of organizations, including Cancer Care, came together to create a user-friendly online database of resources. You go to the website, you put in your zip code, you put in your diagnosis, and it pulls up both local and national resources. So it's just a good place to start. And then I also would like to mention the Patient Advocate Foundation. And what they do, they provide case management and advocacy to help you with financial concerns. That's what they do. That's their area of expertise. You can find them online, and that's www.patientadvocate.org. And then you can also reach them by phone, and that's 1-800-532-5274. So those, again, are just some places you can call, you can go to help you navigate some of this and help you also organize some of it. And then I'm just going to briefly talk about specific patient assistance programs that can help with medications and copays. One of the big ones is Good Days, which was formerly known as the Chronic Disease Fund, if you're familiar with them. And they currently do have copay assistance available for medications and prescription assistance. You can apply right online, and that's www.gooddaysfromcdf, so that just stands for Chronic Disease Fund, .org. And then you can also call them to apply, which is 877-968-7233. So they have a specific program currently available for liver cancer, and then I'm going to talk about two others that will help you find assistance. So there's the Partnership for Prescription Assistance. This organization specifically will help you find assistance to get either free or reduced cost prescription medicines related to your treatment. You can go online and get assistance from them at www.ppaRx.org, and you can also call them, and that's 1-888-477-2669. And then there's another organization that does provide a similar service called Needy Meds. And again, you can contact them, either their website or call them, and you will find listings of other programs out there that can provide either free or reduced cost prescription medicines. Needy Meds, their web address is www.needymeds.org. And you can also call them on their helpline, which is 1-800-503-6897. So in short, really, you want to get informed. You want to speak up, and that means talking to your doctors, talking to the medical team, really being open about your financial situation so they then are aware and can help you, and then getting organized. And, you know that all of these organizations, even the medical team, everyone is really here to help you do some of this. So I'm going to shift gears a little bit and talk about another important resource that I feel you need on this journey, which is support, and how creating a support network really can help you as you're going through this. And I'm going to talk about Cancer Care as a part of that network. So Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization. We provide free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. We provide individual counseling. We do that face-to-face in the New York area. We do it over the phone nationally. We have support groups. We do those face-to-face in the New York area. We do them over the phone nationally and also provide them online, and that's both nationally and internationally. We have education programs like the one we're on today, practical help. We can help you navigate some of this in the healthcare system. We also have some limited financial assistance. All of our services are provided by licensed master's-level oncology social workers, and as I said before, they're completely free of charge. And an oncology social worker really is someone who's trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her family and friends, so how it affects really the entire support network. We're also trained to help patients and their families tackle the problems that accompany the disease. You know, earlier I was talking about the financial demands, but also physical changes, social adjustment, the psychological impact, and just the overall care. And I think that adjusting to and finding ways of coping with the diagnosis is an important part of the healing process, and I actually think of it as part of the treatment. So asking for help, which I talked about in terms of the financial stress, is also important with support. Asking for help, joining a support group, contacting a social worker, all of this is really a sign of strength. I'd like for you to take home with you that you do not have to do this on your own. You don't have to walk the path alone. In joining a support group, you're really connecting with others who are going through a similar situation or having similar problems. It's a great way to give support, get support, and also have that mutual exchange of information. With individual counseling, you have a space that's just yours to voice these concerns that are coming up. And I think the connections really help lessen the isolation that many people with cancer and their loved ones experience. Feeling well emotionally helps you better deal with the diagnosis and treatment. At this time, Cancer Care is offering a number of support groups and, of course, our individual counseling. If you are interested in learning about any of these services, you can always visit our website. We have an incredibly comprehensive website, and that's www.cancercare.org. You can also call us on our Hope line, and that's 1-800-813-HOPE or 1-800-813-4673. And again, you know, we are here. So if you're interested in our services, call us. If you have questions about today's call, call us. I know there's a lot of information to digest and get our arms around. We're really here to help you understand what it means for you and your loved ones. And please remember that you're not alone. You don't have to walk this path alone. Our services and Cancer Care's oncology social workers are really here to help you with this. Thanks so much for your attention and the opportunity to talk today.
Oh, thank you so much, Kelly. That was so, Sarah, thank you so much, Ms. Kelly, for this very, very comprehensive and excellent presentation. Really outstanding. Thank you. And I know there'll be questions now during the Q&A, and so I'm going to ask Amanda to explain to everybody how to queue up for questions. I'm going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. Amanda?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Our first question comes from Sue O. Your line is open.
Oh, hi. I have a question for Sarah Kelly, the social worker.
Yes, please. Yes, your question.
Hi. I'm a social worker also who is I have CLL, which is chronic lymphocytic leukemia. So the first thing I wanted to do for anybody out there that has CLL is that they can call the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, and they give about $5,000 a year for money for treatment or prescriptions. Mm-hmm. The other thing is that one thing that happened to me was when I was diagnosed, I lost a lot of friends, and then when I need chemo, a lot of people abandoned me, and I really didn't understand it. I wrote to Yalom. He's a very famous psychiatrist, and he explained to me that it had nothing to do with me, and it was death anxiety, which people have to confront their own mortality.
And did you have a question you wanted to ask, or did you something that you'd like
yeah,
to...
Yeah, I wanted to... Dr. Ryan and I decided to do research, and we found out that many hospitals are starting psycho-oncology programs, and... I got involved with about 40 hospitals across the country, and I was wondering if you had any information about how to start a psycho-oncology program.
Well, thank you. These are wonderful comments and questions. I'm going to ask Ms. Kelly if she could address the need for support, because you raised such an important point, and also the fact that many hospitals, of course, and many organizations offer support at this time. So, Ms. Kelly, if you could address this really excellent, these excellent points that have been made. Thank you.
Absolutely. So you did make excellent points, and, you know, I think you really hit the nail on the head with what happens when someone's diagnosed, that feeling of abandonment, that loss of many supports because maybe the friends and family don't know what to say, or they are scared. They do have that anxiety because, of course, you know, even if you're diagnosed with a treatable cancer, you may feel that, okay, mortality is right there. Again, with that, it is reaching out to supports. If there is a psycho-oncology program, absolutely reaching out. You know, we're here. I know a lot of treatment centers are also providing this. The Institute of Medicine came out with a report talking about cancer care for the whole patient, and that included psycho-oncology, so it's so important. And then I'll just briefly say, you know, if you're looking to start programs, really, if you're in a treatment center or hospital, connecting with other hospital social workers who are in oncology to talk about how are they implementing it? What are some ways that they can implement that in their center?
Excellent. Thank you. And our next question?
Our next question comes from Terry H. Your line is open.
Yes, hi. I have a question about fatty liver.
Could you, a little bit of static on your line or... So we're having trouble hearing you.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. I have a question about fatty liver.
Could you take yourself off speakerphone? I think that might be the problem.
Okay, let me see here. Yeah. Let's see. Let me go back. Okay. I'm sorry. Give me 1 second. Okay. Can you hear me better?
Yes. Much better.
Okay.
Thank you. Thanks.
All right. I have a question about a fatty liver. I was diagnosed with ovarian cancer, and it had affected my liver, and then I just had a reoccurrence, and I had 3 spots on my liver. And I was just wondering, I am in remission now, no evidence of disease, but I'm in question about a fatty liver and how, you know, if that has something to do with it affecting my liver each time, or if I can reverse that somehow.
Thank you. Excellent question. Dr. Harding, can you address this question in a general way? And then, of course, we'll suggest that our caller go back to her treating healthcare team. But if you could just address this in a general way.
Yeah, of course. So one of the, I think, major issues, particularly in the United States, but in other developed countries, is that we're recognizing an entity called non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, which is really, it's a very complex biologic process where over time fat molecules are deposited in the liver, and in a very small, in a subset of patients, these fat molecules lead to inflammation, which ultimately lead to cirrhosis or scarring of the liver. We're now recognizing that this probably is a risk factor for hepatocellular carcinoma. The question really is, you know, is there anything that can be done regarding fatty liver disease? I mean, one aspect is, you know, it seems that this might occur from other issues related to health, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, perhaps dietary factors, exercise, and sometimes it has nothing to do with this, and it's a genetic cause. For overall across, I mean, I think the United States, the idea would be to control these risk factors and increase level of activity, et cetera. Fatty liver disease is actually becoming a major reason for liver transplant now in the United States as well. So it is becoming more of a problem. And I don't think we fully understand the biology of it once it has occurred, and once it has occurred with liver cancer, is there a way to reverse that? And this is why people are actively investigating that. And obviously, when you're free of cancer, you know, it's important to maintain your whole health and continue with continued follow-up scans. I hope that answers the question.
Well, excellent. Thank you so much. That's really excellent. And we had a question also from one of our online participants, actually, about sort of nutrition during treatment. And I'm wondering if Ms. Bearden could address questions just about what people can do during treatment really to help with their just general nutrition and ability to take in food, things like that.
Yeah, like I was talking about in my presentation, obviously we have to address side effects, and the diet will be a little bit more personalized based on that. But if you're not having any side effects, really we encourage, just a balanced diet, a plant-based diet. When we're just looking at fatty liver in general, we figure out the source of it, determine the source of it, and then if you're overweight or obese, encouraging patients to have a healthy weight loss through diet and exercise. It's really, individual, but everybody has specific, unique factors, in their health care and how to address those. So if you're going through treatment, definitely work with your team because it may not necessarily be completely appropriate to make some significant changes at that time, but the ultimate goal with diet is to have a healthy, balanced diet, get it to a healthy weight, and incorporate physical activity.
Thank you. And there is a question about seeking a second opinion. Should I get a second opinion before starting treatment? Dr. Harding, could you address this in a general way, of course?
Sure. I think that for certain cancers, which are, at least in the United States, rarer, there are only about 45,000 cases of liver cancer per year in the United States. I think that an opinion probably should be rendered at a center that has a multidisciplinary approach. That means cancer surgeons or radiation oncologists, interventional radiologists, medical oncologists, and I think that's probably important. And if you've done that, it's really up to a person's level of comfort if they want a second opinion at another sort of cancer center. There are mechanisms to do that. Just by calling referral lines at the major cancer centers, and they can try to pair you with an expert. Sometimes I think that it's reasonable to wait for a second opinion, but it really does depend on the specifics of your medical care at that time. Sometimes patients can become quite sick from cancer, and they may need treatment sooner. In fact, I actually would
have no problem asking my current doctor, do you think I can get a second opinion, and do you even recommend a center? Because as oncologists, we kind of work together, and especially as sort of at these larger academic centers, we'll refer patients to one another for clinical trials that we don't have available. And really, the person to ask sometimes is your doctor, because they know you well, and they know, you know, how quickly you might need treatment. And I think that that's important as well. I hope that answers the question.
Oh, that's really excellent. Thank you. Well, I want to thank our speakers. They've really been extraordinary today. This has been an extraordinary call. I want to thank all of you who have been listening, and all of you who've queued up and asked questions to really enhance the call today with your questions and comments and recommendations. And I also want to remind all of you, this is a one-hour program, and that in planning a program like this, we all recognize that you have many needs that go far beyond the scope of 1 hour. So I do want to remind all of you again about all of the different services that you can access from Cancer Care, which Sarah Kelly did an excellent job reviewing with all of you. Most importantly, we don't want anyone to leave this call feeling like you're alone in coping with your cancer or with liver cancer. We want you to feel like you're part now of the cancer care community, and that if you're feeling that you need someone to talk to, if you feel that you need financial assistance or practical help, if you feel that you'd like to join one of our support groups, either on the telephone or online, or if you just feel like you're sort of feeling like I need someone to talk to, you can call us at 1-800-813-HOPE. Now, if you have a medical question on today's call that you did not get a chance to ask, or if you have a follow-up medical question, please do call the National Cancer Institute. The National Cancer Institute has a number of information specialists, and they are all awaiting your call after each of our programs. They're actually there waiting for you to call them. And their number is 1-800-422-6237. So again, for medically oriented questions that you may have about liver cancer or other types of cancer, call 1-800-422-6237. And again, I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This does conclude the workshop. You may now disconnect. Everyone have a wonderful day.